in this Radio EcoShock program.
There have been five major extinctions. One was the KT extinction, which was the asteroid into the Yucatan, but the other four were warming events. And the worst was the Permian extinction, some 95% species extinction. And what happened in the Permian in this warming event, it was triggered by CO2 coming out of Siberian volcanoes, the so-called Siberian traps, at a rate estimated at 1/100th the rate at which the humans are currently putting out CO2. But these positive feedbacks include the escape of massive amounts of fossil methane and fossil CO2 out of the tundra and out of the oceans. Today, there are huge melt lakes in Siberia, for example, the Siberian tundra, the size of France and Germany, people tell me, where the methane is bubbling out very fast. And methane is 22 times worse than CO2.
I'm your host and disturber, Alex Smith. Actually, I'm just a recorded voice this week. The real Alex is off in nature, thinking the whole thing over. Big picture in the big country, listening to tales from a mountain river. We have a guest host this week, KMO from the Sea Realm podcast. And his guest is one Dennis M. Bushnell, chief scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center. Langley? That sounds awfully close to the CIA, and Bushnell does have top secret clearance and cryptographic telephones. He's got patents in aerothermodynamics. He solves glitches that might crash military planes or space vehicles, and he's published hundreds of times. Oh yeah, and Dennis Bushnell thinks we are at the doorstep of doom because of climate change. He has also believable organic solutions that could save us without nuclear power or mirrors blocking the sun. Bushnell is interviewed very well, I think, by KMO, one of the most unique podcasters out there. It's called Sea Realm, and C stands for consciousness. Many of the latest podcasts have been about the collision of threats facing the planet today, climate change, peak oil, and such. The rest are about KMO's other passion, Amazonian shamanism. There aren't many things I don't know anything about. Anything at all. I like to think I'm well-traveled, well-read. On most topics, I can at least fake it. Not this one. I know absolutely nothing about the mind-melding medicines of the Peruvian Andes, the teacher Ayahuasca, the shamans and the curanderos. Maybe someday I'll listen more to KMO and find out. But today, we're going to travel with NASA's chief scientist as he sees ultimate climate change. It will be interesting to see how you hear this program. My first reaction, true worrier that I am, we are absolutely doomed to extinction. In an email, KMO had the opposite feeling, that Dennis Bushnell's vision shows us solutions and a way out that we all can live with. It's up to you. Here is the Sea Realm podcast number 108, June 25th, 2008, Methane Burps and Tella Everything.
Hello, and welcome to another installment of the Sea Realm Podcast. I am your host, KMO, and this is episode number 108, Methane Burps and Tella Everything, prepared for release onto the World Wide Web on Wednesday, June 25th, 2008. In this installment of the Sea Realm Podcast, I will be talking with Dennis M. Bushnell. He is the chief scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center, and we'll be talking about climate change and some other topics that are generally familiar to the Sea Realm audience. Dennis M. Bushnell is, as I mentioned, the chief scientist at NASA's Langley Research Center. He is responsible for technical oversight and advanced program formulation with emphasis in the areas of atmospheric sciences and structures, materials, acoustics, flight electronics, control software, instruments, aerodynamics, aerothermodynamics, hypersonic air-breathing propulsion, computational sciences, and systems optimization for aeronautics, spacecraft, exploration, and space access. During his 43-year career, he has authored 247 publications and major presentations and 280 invited lectures and seminars. And he is also the holder of 5 patents. He is a member of the National Academy of Engineering and a fellow of ASME, AIAA, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and serves on the advisory board of the Lifeboat Foundation. He holds numerous awards and distinctions from governmental agencies, professional societies, and academia. He has served numerous national and international organizations as consultant or committee member. He has served as reviewer and editor for 40 journals and organizations. And with that introduction fresh in your mind, here is my conversation with Dennis M. Bushnell.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. C stands for consciousness.
Welcome back to the Sea Realm Podcast. I'm your host, KMO, and joining me on the line is Dennis M. Bushnell. He is the chief scientist of NASA's Langley Research Center. Dennis Bushnell, welcome to the Sea Realm Podcast.
Very glad to be here, sir.
And I will acknowledge Carl N. He is a Sea Realm listener, and it was his idea to arrange this interview, so I'd like to send out a thanks to Carl. And Carl got in touch with you because you are currently very articulate in spreading a particular message about energy, climate, the near future, and some possible reasons to be optimistic about the long-term future and our energy needs and the state of the climate. And I know you've been giving a lot of presentations on that topic. And if you would, just go ahead and share the message with the Sea Realm audience that you have been sharing with other audiences at the various conferences that you've been addressing.
The message is composed of several parts. The first part is, why are we worried about energy? If you're buying gasoline, you know. The peak oil was in 05, 06, and 07. The world produced about 86 million barrels a day each of those years, and the production is expected to go down. Alternatives from tar sand shale and oil from coal is expected to be much more expensive, produce much less net energy, and also produce far more CO2. So there's a current economic reason for wanting to replace petroleum, and that it's becoming rather too expensive. Going forward, just like there's a peak petroleum in the current age, going forward, we expect peak uranium in 2025 or so with the current once-through fuel cycles. And even people have done some studies on peak coal out in the 2050, 2060 timeframe. The price of coal was going way up. The price of uranium's going way up. It's all going way up. So we have to do something. So economics is the first reason why we need to do something else for energy. The second reason is, of course, warming. And the current IPCC predictions are for the globe by 2100, some 5 to 6 degrees centigrade max, and maybe up to a meter on the ocean rise. The IPCC has not included various feedback loops, because the science is not yet solid enough for them to include it. But these positive feedbacks include the escape of massive amounts of fossil methane and fossil CO2 out of the tundra and out of the oceans. Today, there are huge melt lakes in Siberia, for example, the Siberian tundra, the size of France and Germany, people tell me, where the methane is bubbling out very fast. And methane is 22 times worse than CO2. So the initial human CO2 emissions, anthropogenic, are inciting various positive feedback mechanisms, fossil methane, fossil CO2, and also as the increased CO2 is goes into the ocean becomes acidic, weak carbolic acid. And as the temperature rises, the ocean can take up less of the CO2, which is a problem. All of these positive feedbacks produce yet more albedo changes, i.e. melt more ice faster. And also, these changes are happening much, much faster than anyone thought. 5 years ago, the IPCC predictions were, ice-free Arctic in the summertime, maybe by 2100. based on the way the ice has been melting. 3 years ago, they said, no, it's not 2100, it's 2040. And then just last December, as I remember, they came out and said, no, the way the ice is really melting now is probably 2014. So we really don't know what's going on, except that what's going on is much faster. Then there's a book which I believe will be long considered a milestone in this whole warming and energy discussion, and that's Peter Ward's recent book called Under a Green Sky. Peter Ward is a paleobotanist, and he's been looking, he and his compatriots, in the fossil record at previous extinctions in geological ages. This is not any recent ice age. This is way back in the geological age. There have been five major extinctions. One was the KT extinction, which was the asteroid into the Yucatan, but the other four were warming events. And the worst was the Permian extinction, some 95% species extinction. And what happened in the Permian in this warming event, it was triggered by CO2 coming out of Siberian volcanoes, the so-called Siberian traps, at a rate estimated at 1/100th the rate at which the humans are currently putting out CO2. What happened in the Permian is these positive feedback loops were engaged and the ocean circulator shut down. And once that shut down, the oceans went anoxic, i.e. low oxygen. And we're currently losing chunks of the ocean today the size of Texas each year to these anoxic low oxygen conditions. Once the oceans went anoxic in the Permian, special bacteria started growing that grow in low oxygen conditions. And these bacteria produce massive amounts of hydrogen sulfide. The hydrogen sulfide entered the atmosphere, turned the atmosphere toxic and unbreathable, and went up and took down the ozone layer. And in the fossil record, in Peter's book, he indicates that you can see in the fossil record where the vegetation was fried by this radiation. The life forms that survived this are usually in some few parts of the ocean, which still has some oxygen in it. So we're on the path to apparently, possibly, repeat the Permian, only this time instead of volcanoes, the inciting activity is anthropogenic CO2 release. This is not good. With the feedback mechanisms, by 2100, we're looking at possibly 12 to 14 degrees C, and beyond 2100, 20, 30, 40 years beyond 2100, at those temperatures, all the ice melts, including the Antarctic, and estimates are 75 to 80 meter ocean rise, which would drown out the current domiciles of something like 2.4 billion people, about one-third of the population. So what do we do about it? And my messages are straightforward. We need to replace the 80% of the energy that humans now use, which is derived from fossil carbon producing CO2. This includes petroleum, coal, and natural gas. To replace petroleum, i.e. heavy fuels for transportation mostly, the way to do that is with biofuels, only not ethanol biofuels, which are not good for many ways. We can go into that if you want. And not particularly cellulosic biofuels, which is the other green parts of the plants, because we don't have enough cellulosic biofuels, because cellulosic biofuels are produced on arable land with fresh water, compete with food, and all kinds of other problems. So, you know, where do we get the biofuels? And the answer is we get it with a little revolution in biomass using deserts and wastelands, seawater, and plant stock, including halophytes. Halo is salt, so halophytes are salt plants, and worldwide there's 10,000 species of plants that grow in brackish water, salt water. On the shorelines of the Indian subcontinent, they've had a brackish water irrigation for centuries, growing food and fodder with the brackish water. About 44% of the landmass worldwide is in fact deserts and wastelands. This includes Western Australia, around the Persian Gulf, the Middle East, the Sahara, the Southwest U.S., and so forth. and these areas all have salt water in them. So besides halophytes, one could also use algae in the salt water, and also cyanobacteria. The algae is much more productive. You can harvest that every couple of days compared to the plants, which you harvest, you know, 2-3 times a year. The plants, the halophytes, would produce about 600 gallons per acre a year. The algae is capable now in a demonstration plant. They're producing 33,000 gallons per acre a year, and I think they can go to at least 51,000 gallons per acre a year. So you could produce algae with municipal wastewater treatment plant water. You could produce algae in the Great Salt Lake and the Salton Sea. You could make the eastern equatorial Pacific off of South America part of an algae pond. The estimates are that if we did something straightforward, like plowed up a good chunk of the Sahara only, irrigated it with the Mediterranean, that we could, on just doing that, using just halophytes, not with the algae or the cyanobacteria, we could produce all of the biomass needed to replace all of the fossil carbon, produce all of the petroleum, produce all of the food, because many of these plants can be converted and made into food. And that would allow the 67% of the fresh water that's now used for conventional agriculture to come back to human use, because we're also running out of fresh water. And also produce all of the petrochemical feedstock out of this biomass that we need for all the plastics and everything else, and never have to use fossil carbon again. So it's biomass using wasteland, seawater, saltwater, brackish water, wastewater, and halophytes, algae, and cyanobacteria, huge capacity there to replace petroleum. To replace coal, there's five approaches. The ones that are 24/7 baseload are drill geothermal and burnt biomass. Drill geothermal, this is not the geothermal like the geysers in Yellowstone and Iceland where the hot rock is up on the surface. This is drilling down 2 kilometers, and the oil well people can drill down 10 kilometers and do. You drill down 2 kilometers on about half of the landmass worldwide, and you get 200 degrees centigrade rock. And this then provides the heat for a fuelless power plant. The other approaches are, of course, wind and solar thermal and solar photovoltaics. Each of these approaches, biomass, wind, drill geothermal, solar thermal, and solar photovoltaics, have the capacity, the energy capacity, which is an order of magnitude greater than what's required to replace fossil carbon. So the capacity is there. It's a matter of doing it. How soon could we do it? In the case of the biomass, if we really seriously went after it, probably 10 to 15 years. For replacing coal, maybe 20 to 25 years by the time we get all through. A lot of these technologies are very supportive of a distributed energy production approach, which is where you can buy now with a credit card both manifestations of and plans for a home which is totally off the grid, off the energy grid, off of the water grid, off of the waste grid, and even off the food grid. And so distributed energy production via photovoltaics, via wind, via a whole bunch of areas, passive solar and whatnot, is an emerging, very viable thing. I think in Denmark, 50-some percent of their energy is now produced, distributed. In terms of costs, the estimates are by the National Renewable Energy Lab and or MIT, the cost issues are the following. For biomass, by 2020, the estimates are $1 a gallon, which is a whole lot less than what we're paying now. For wind, it's about, well, first of all, coal currently, coal electricity is about 5 to 6 cents a kilowatt hour. If we force coal to sequester the CO2 underground, that boosts the coal price up to 9 cents a kilowatt hour. Wind is currently 6 to 7 cents. Biomass is 8 to 9 cents. Drill geothermal is 6 to 7 cents. Solar thermal by 2010 is expected to be 7 cents. Solar photovoltaics by 2020 is expected to be something like 8 cents. So All of these renewables will be cheaper than coal with sequestration, but the prices for energy will go up somewhat. But as we do more technology going forward, we can probably pull those prices down.
Well, that was quite a bit of information, and I hope you don't mind if I go back and ask you to repeat and elaborate on some of it. Start with,
of course,
we're talking about replacing fossil fuels with a variety of biofuels that are produced using what are now marginal lands or wastelands or things that we cannot use for agriculture. So that sort of eliminates the objection to biofuels that it competes with food. Also, we mentioned, or you mentioned this to me when we spoke on the phone earlier this week, the types of fuel that we would get from these processes, particularly from the bacteria, is basically crude oil, which means that we can use the existing oil infrastructure to move that liquid fuel around. Is that right? Do I have that right? And is there anything you need to add to that?
Yeah, that's right. Back in Bush 2-1, there was some serious talk and work on a hydrogen economy. The hydrogen just stores energy. The hydrogen would need a separate infrastructure. The biofuels do not, except for ethanol. Ethanol is burns through seals and so forth, the alcohol. But by and large, biofuels use existing infrastructure. Hydrogen, you would have to build an infrastructure which would be almost unaffordable. Also, it's hard to store hydrogen. The biofuels are easy to store. So it's essentially a direct replacement. The Brits are now selling a bioreactor, as I understand it, which goes on your back porch, and you put in your grass clippings, your leaves, your kitchen scraps, and your sewage, and you produce fuels to run your vehicle with. The algae is particularly interesting because algae is a lipid. It's up to about 60% oil, and so an olive oil press is suitable to produce something that's burnable, and then using various post-processing, which is far less expensive than what we now do for oil refining, and can be done in a distributed fashion. You know, one can make just about whatever fuel that you want. We've been successful in taking salt plants, halophytes, and converting that into JP fuel for aircraft.
Now, there is the question of carbon. When we burn fossil fuels, we are releasing carbon into the atmosphere, which was essentially sequestered by nature several million years ago. So we are increasing the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. When we produce oil, even if it is, you know, functionally just like the oil we get out of the ground, the carbon there is carbon that was sequestered just recently when we were growing the plants or the algae or whatever it is that we're using as a biomass to make the stuff. So does that make the biofuels completely carbon neutral or even carbon negative?
They can be carbon negative. A lot of these plants have very deep root systems, and when you use the top of the plant for biomass, you don't particularly pull the roots up, so all of the carbon that's sequestered in the roots tends to stay there. There are special terra preta soils in the Amazon, which are very productive, and it turns out that 800, 1200 years ago or so, the Indians down in the Amazon basin in these areas produced a lot of charcoal, which they buried into the soil and made the soils extremely productive. And, of course, this is another way to sequester. But you're exactly right. The biofuels are, this is essentially a closed CO2 cycle. You would take CO2 out of the atmosphere, the plant takes it up, and then when you burn the upper part of the plant, the CO2 goes back in the atmosphere, and then you pull it back out. There are other ways to generate energy that are being looked at, and we'll probably touch on those as we go through the interview. But one of them is an effort begun in Germany and by UC San Diego, and later joined at Livermore and Sandia, where people have extracted carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere. They then use solar energy to strip an oxygen atom off, producing carbon monoxide, which is a fuel. It has a heating value of about 1/4 of the conventional hydrocarbons, and can be made into other usual hydrocarbon fuels. So it is possible without using the plants to directly reprocess, recirculate in a closed system the atmospheric CO2.
Concerning the question of global warming, one thing that I've read in interviews with you that I've read online is that you like to distinguish between two different kinds of warming. And if you would, tell us about those.
The CO2 warming is warming where we're changing the atmosphere, so we're trapping heat. The second law of warming we won't have to worry about for another 150, 200 years, but we will eventually have to worry about it. And that's the fact that as humans use energy, the second law of thermodynamics says we have to reject waste heat. And there's now enough humans using enough energy, particularly as the rest of the world comes up to U.S. energy use, to reject enough waste heat so that the whole Earth has to warm to reject that waste heat to space. That space rejection process is modulated, altered by atmospheric warming. But, you know, we're about 2.5 orders of magnitude away from the whole ball having to warm. So, but it means that long term, we need to generate energy through processes that do not generate new waste heat. Anything solar does not generate new waste heat, whether it's wind, or solar thermal, solar photovoltaics, and also tidal energy doesn't particularly generate new waste heat. But others do. That includes any fossil carbon. That includes even geothermal, because that heat was below the Earth. It wasn't up in the atmosphere where we had to radiate it away. And it includes anything nuclear. So, but this is a problem, you know, we have to solve the current warming problem and quit putting up all this CO2 that stays up there forever. And with Peter Ward's book, Warming, the atmospheric CO2 warming with the positive feedbacks, and particularly the production of the hydrogen sulfide, which, if that occurs, warming becomes existential. This is far more than a hot day and wet feet.
Well, since you've mentioned the word existential, let me just bring up the topic of existential risks. In addition to being the chief scientist at NASA Langley Research Center, you are also on the advisory board for the Lifeboat Foundation. So if you would take a few minutes and talk about existential risks and the mission of the Lifeboat Foundation and what your role there is.
Well, I'm on their advisory board, as are a great number of other people. The purpose of the Lifeboat Foundation is to try to anticipate the potential existential risk to the humans going forward as we prosecute what is essentially something that we've never done and seen before, which is a simultaneous IT bio nano quantum energetics double exponential tech revolution. All of these tech revolutions are at the frontiers of the small. They're all in a feeding frenzy off of each other, and they're all changing things in massive ways. And those changes can have potential existential effects upon the humankind. Now, there are some existential risks which are not connected to human activities, such as asteroid impact and things of that nature, acts of nature. But many of them, in fact, one that I was working this morning has to do with currently we have come since 59 and silicon computer improvements in speed by about 10 to the 7th, 10 million. We're currently at about a petaflop. The human brain speed is 20 petaflops. Will be at human brain speed by 2012, so the machines will be as smart as human brains. Beyond that, as we leave silicon and go to bio-optical, quantum, nano, and molecular computing, we're looking at an additional speed increase beyond human brain speed of somewhere between 10 to the 7th to 10 to the 11th by 2030, 2040-ish. That's a massive, massive machine capability. So the speed will be there to produce an intelligence beyond human. Well, what about the software? Well, the software comes from either the current soft computing, genetic algorithms, neural nets, fuzzy logic, and derivatives thereof, AGI, or from biomimetics. IBM has a major effort run out of Switzerland, which is where most of their S&Ts are, scientists and technologists, which is called the Blue Brain Project. Started this, I think, in 05. And they've made great progress, and what they've done is they've nanosectioned the neocortex, the higher part of the mammalian brain, and they're replicating that silicon down to molecular level. So essentially they're growing an artificial human brain. Then there's emergence, and the humans, as far as we can tell, there is no general intelligence wiring in the human. Each piece of our intelligence evolved in the usual million-year evolutionary context over which we developed as today's humans to handle specific problems within that evolutionary context, almost all of which was in the hunter-gatherer mode. Any general intelligence we have is wholly emergent, i.e. you make something complex enough and it wakes up. So between emergence, biomimetics, and soft computing, people are betting that by 2025, 2030, we may start to approach, or once we approach, exceed human-level machine intelligence. If that happens, then this may become an existential threat. It's one of the existential threats that are being looked at by the lifeboat people. Because once the machines get smarter than us, they can do things which could take us down even inadvertently. You don't even have to postulate an evil machine to do this. And so how do you work this going forward to make sure that in the brainstem of the machines, in the lizard part of their brain, okay, that they understand and it's built into them from the initial stages not to harm humans in any way, shape, or form. So we have to define what harm is.
You're listening to the Sea Realm Podcast. Blowing your mind one week at a time.
Yes, this is Radio EcoShock. Through the magic of radio, you have been teleported to the Sea Realm Podcast. Host KMO is interviewing the chief scientist of NASA's Langley Research Center. This is episode 108 of the listener-supported podcast. Find it at sea-realm.org. We'll be back in 30 seconds. I'm Alex Smith, and I'm out exploring nature. This week, we're listening to KMO, who goes by the initials KMO, questioning NASA Langley Chief Scientist Dennis M. Bushnell. It's a strange mix in a way. KMO also podcasts on Peruvian shamanism, while Bushnell works deep within the military space complex. Bushnell once told CBS News, "This is why I tend to work with military people. I can get them scared and worried, so it's not just me being scared and worried. Hey, that's my line. Isn't that why I do the Radio EcoShock show?" Back to podcast 108 KMO with Dennis M. Bushnell.
As much as I am tempted to pursue the artificial intelligence conversation, I would like to go back to the energy conversation, just because there are a number of things that I would like to have you clarify and elaborate on. And the first, I think, and this is probably the most important for me, is just coming to terms with the fact that no matter what ideological position one wants to take with respect to global climate change, one can find folks who have seemingly bona fide credentials who say that who say whatever it is that you want them to say. What needs to be done in order to convince those who would like to believe that there is no problem and who have experts that they can point to verify or to bolster their claim that climate change is not a problem? What can you say to perhaps get these people to reconsider their position?
Well, I'm an engineer by training. I'm fairly objective, or at least try to be, and it's a matter of evidence. The IPCC is a very distinguished group of scientists, technologists, who have studied this problem long and hard, probably more than anybody else, and they have reached a consensus with some very solid evidence. And so, of the people wandering around in singlets and doublets and triplets compared to 1,000 or so of the best people on the planet, I would tend to believe 1,000 are the best people on the planet. What worries me is not that the IPCC is right. What worries me and sometimes terrifies me is that the IPCC may be exceedingly conservative, because they have not included all of these feedbacks. Their predictions do not agree with the data. The data indicate things are changing far faster. The ice is melting far faster. I went through that. The oceans are warming about 50% faster than the people thought. The CO2 is going up far faster than people thought from the IPCC predictions. And now we've got this Peter Ward book, Under Green Sky, which casts this whole thing in a much broader and far more worrisome context. But I don't have to wave the warming and energy thing very far at all to get people to consider changing the energetics. Changing the oil energetics, I think, is absolutely a slam dunk economic case. If it turns out that not only is the price of gasoline going up and that will change our lifestyles measurably, but if it turns out that there are major geopolitical issues, if there wasn't oil in the Middle East, would we do what we're doing? And also some half at least, and probably now with the price of oil going up greater, but at least half of our huge balance of payments, $600 to $700 billion a year, current accounts deficit, is oil. Okay? And it's that huge balance of payments deficit which is responsible for the devaluation of the dollar, as I understand. And that balance of payments deficit is greater than the entire world's net saving. We can't keep doing this. We're a huge debtor nation. And getting off of oil and going to, domestically produced biofuels. If you went to cellulosic biofuels, it would take an appreciable part of the U.S. landmass growing stuff in order to replace petroleum, like 30 to 40% numbers I've seen. If you go to algae, you're down less than a percent or two. That's a very big difference. And, along the way now, this whole conversation needs to be put in the context of ever more aggressive conservation. If it turns out, the estimates I've seen that are if we went to serious conservation, we could reduce U.S. energy use about 30%. So you combine aggressive conservation, i.e. lowering the bridge while you're raising the river or whatever, then you could both reduce the amount of energy that you need, develop the technology fairly readily so that you can generate most of what you need locally, and this would have a major impact upon the security of the power grid and all kinds of other infrastructures, which right now are a little bit vulnerable terrorism-wise. So there are all kinds of national security, geopolitical, geoeconomic, and plain old pocketbook issues here as far as petroleum. For coal is harder. From an economic point of view, if you don't sequester coal is cheaper now. In 15 to 20, 25 years, it may not be, particularly as these renewable technologies develop. So the warming and energy thing has a great impact of when we do something about coal and what we do. But in terms of petroleum, you don't have to go near the environmental issue in order to work petroleum.
The person who initially contacted you about this interview, his name is Pearl, he sent some questions along that he asked me to put to you. And there are several questions here. I'm going to read them all at once, and I'll just let you sort of pick and choose among them. If you were Barack Obama's energy czar, what would you suggest as policy? An Energy Manhattan Project, a global energy summit, as the Saudis have been suggesting? How should all the countries of the world cooperate so as to be most sensible about energy development, globalization, and the environment moving forward?
Okay. Those are essentially two questions. One is, what should be the national energy policy? And the other is, what should we do about international cooperation? In terms of a national energy policy, I don't think you need a Manhattan Project. I don't think that you need an energy summit. We had, in fact, I'm a member of the National Academy of Engineering, and the National Academy recently had some kind of an energy summit where we had boardmen from energy and a whole bunch of other people in and talked over all of these options and so forth. The national energy policy should be to set forth policy regulations and perhaps laws such as the carbon sequestration to encourage the private sector to go work and enable renewables. The going to renewables, going to carbon neutral, is, in my opinion, far less of a technology issue than it is a sunk costs in existing investments, need to amortize existing investments, pay them off, and people's aversion, innate aversion to change. There's part of our brain called the amygdala, which develops specifically to make sure we remain conservative. Because if you change too much too fast in the hunter-gatherer context, the animals eat you. Okay, so it was good to keep using things and not change too fast. But at the same time, without change, then there's total stagnation. So this is a tightrope, and it's always been so within our human development. But I think that there is sufficient power in regulation, policy, and a few statutes to really turn this thing around. And do it rapidly. Now, you can't do that without upsetting some iron rice bowls. Things are going to change. Some people, some boats are going to rise, others are going to end up on the mudflats. And, so you mitigate those as much as you can. But overall, the estimates are that with conservation, with the rest of it, the energy prices should come way down. The estimates of biofuels at $1 a gallon out in the 2020 time frame, I find very intriguing. The other issue was about what do we do about international cooperation. Internationally, we all share the same atmosphere. As I understand it, China and India are waiting for the U.S. to take the lead on carbon sequestration and carbon taxes and reducing carbon seriously. Once we do it, I think they've committed to do it, and they probably will. And in fact, China has a huge renewables industry going on in the solar and wind and many other components. And if we're not careful, they're going to beat us to this new source of jobs and economic growth. Once whatever further evidence is acquired to convince the bulk of the people that this warming and energy thing is A, real, and B, very worrisome to existential, once that happens, then I think you will see the peoples of the world come together in a global consilience that we have never seen on any other subject. because this is a common enemy, as it were. And of course, as you know, Paul Golan famously said, you know, the enemy is us. Currently, with the way people are living currently on the globe, the estimates are we're short about 30% of a planet to avoid taking down the whole ecosystem, just to due to the humans. I mean, there's just too many of us living too well, for the ecosystem to sustain us. If the U.S., if the rest of the world comes up to U.S. living standards and so forth, then we're going to need 3 to 4 more planets. The ecosystem's going down. And, by the way, the rest of the world is, in fact, very rapidly coming up to U.S. living standards. So we're going to have to do something, okay? The litany of changes occurring, you know, include all kinds of diseases and droughts and floods and everything else. Let me give you one example. I talked about initially a large amount of fossil methane in the oceans and in the tundra. There's large amounts off of the seacoast, large amounts off of Carolina, for example, the Carolinas, and off of most of the coastal areas. Wherever they looked for fossil methane down under the ocean, they found it in general. And people are worried that this methane, as the seas warm and they are warming, could burp, and if it burps, it could slump the continental shelf and produce a tidal wave, which could take out millions of people on the U.S. East Coast. There was a fairly major, not major, but a fairly large methane burp off of San Diego, as I remember, last year. In fact, it was on television. They had pictures of it, the whole stuff gassing out. So in terms of the international context, I think for the first time we will have a common cause for all the peoples once the evidence is in to the point and once people have swallowed the fact that
changes require. Well, you mentioned the prospect of a common enemy, that being global climate change and the effects that would fall out from it, providing the conditions that would lead to a sort of global consilience, you said. And I know that some people, and I've mentioned these people before, these are the ones who choose their scientific view on climate change to match their political views. They are very fearful that this whole notion of climate change is largely a ruse concocted by elites in power to soften the way or prepare the way for the advent of a global governance that does not exist at this time. And I don't really expect you to take on that sort of, some would say, paranoid view head on. But what I would like to stress is that you are not necessarily calling for a new world order in order to address climate change. In fact, you've talked about doing this on a very distributed scale and doing it even at the level of the household. You wrote in one place that I read about biorefining on a household level. So if you would talk about how we can organize ourselves globally, but not in a way that creates enormous power structures which could be abused or used for other ends. And you also mentioned that, and I hate to overload the question, but this will have to be the last question. You also mentioned when we talked on the phone last week that you were not in favor of things like vertical farming, that we need to disperse the population rather than continue the trend of aggregating people in urban centers. And I think that that is all of a piece with doing things on a very sort of distributed or decentralized model.
Okay. Let me address the last part of it first. As I said, we are on a simultaneous IT bio-nano quantum energetics tech revolution, the earliest of which and the most major one is the IT revolution. The IT revolution is having massive impacts upon human lifestyles and economics. What's evolving is a tele-everything situation, telecommuting. There's purportedly some 46 million U.S. telecommuters. This has been growing by leaps and bounds. 46 million is almost a third of the workforce. Going forward, there's no reason to believe that that number is not going to grow tremendously. something like 212 million Americans do some shopping on the web, as I understand it. So it's teleshopping. So far, teleworking, telecommuting, teleshopping. Then there's telemedicine is coming along, robotic surgery and so forth. There are now machines which will print human organs, so you can print your own stuff, and then the telesurgeon can, you know, put it in your home, presumably. And you also telemanufacturing, there's mechatronics. The Brits are selling a rep-rap machine which goes on your desktop and prints, produces by growing most anything with multiple materials, including electronics, up to something like 30 centimeters. This is where that's going. Teletravel, there's government estimates that by 2016 we may lose up to 40% of the business travelers off of the long-haul airplanes due to teletravel. Telecommerce is obviously endemic. So once you no longer have to drive to work physically, there's not much reason to congregate in built-up areas. I mean, we have, in the latter part of the industrial age, put automobile-enabled suburbs around 18th-century seaports and 19th-century railheads. Some 80% of the population lives within 150 or 200 miles of the seacoast in this country, and that includes the Houston Ship Channel and the Great Lakes and so forth. So vast amounts of this country are not very highly populated. And you could, if you telecommute, have your own 20 acres on a mountaintop somewhere. Generally, when people get rich, that's the first thing they do is they go buy 20 acres of a mountaintop somewhere. So these energy technologies, you know, which are available now, I mean, you can with a credit card, as I mentioned, buy both a manifestation of and plans for an off-the-grid house now. And going forward with the nanotechnology, with the energetics technology, this will only get far better, far less costly, and so forth. So, you know, what could evolve is an individual iconic cottage, okay, which is largely to almost wholly self-sufficient. And that will be part of the way people live as they realize they can do this. I've got all kinds of friends in the technical business who are living in all kinds of weird places, and they're not in cities, okay, because they can do it now, because they telecommute. The tele-education, the most successful university in the country is the University of Phoenix. It has 344,000 students, as I remember, and it's you know, private, totally on the web, fully accredited. I went and briefed some of the Senate staffers one time on the futures of education, got into the telebusiness, and a whole bunch of them stood up and said, yes, Dennis, we were educated on the web. Universities like Stanford are offering courses on the web and in the classroom. And the on-campus students are increasingly taking the courses in the dorm rooms on the web instead of going to class. And so Stanford appears to be approaching a state of a $52,000 a year, whatever it is, social cost. The energy business is not occurring in any kind of isolation. There are all kinds of massive changes otherwise. Massive changes in human life expectancy, in the machine capability, in the robotics. Humans are becoming cyborgs, cochlear implants for hearing, artificial retinas, artificial hearts, brain chips. We have put brain chips in to replace congenitally defective brains, and we're now working on brain chips to improve normal brains. So as to speculation, pure speculation, in 20 to 25 years, you may need the latest brain chip in to compete. So I wouldn't worry about there be some kind of a global government that's going to take over everybody's lives. And in fact, the tele-everything is driving it exactly in the opposite direction. The power of the central governments with the web communications and the information on the web, all of this information availability, the tele-everything, is in fact reducing the power of the central government.
Dennis M. Bushnell, you have raised some very tantalizing issues, but I'm afraid we will not be able to pursue them in this conversation because we are out of time. But I'd like to thank you very much for joining us here in the Sea Realm and for sharing your ideas and these notions that you articulate so well.
You're listening to the Sea Realm podcast. Turn on, tune in, and take heart.
And that is all the time we have for this installment of the Sea Realm podcast. Join me on Friday. I will be playing the last of the interviews recorded by Ayaz Mina for the special Friday episodes of the Sea Realm podcast, the ones that were meant to raise awareness of this year's fourth annual International Amazonian Shamanism Conference being held in Iquitos, Peru. That will be on Friday. I hope that you will join me then, and until that time, I hope that you will stay well.
You have been listening to a super tech expert from NASA, David M. Bushnell, interviewed by a specialist in Amazonian spiritualism, KMO. Actually, I check out KMO's podcast every week now at c-realm.org. That's c-realm.org. And his blog at kmo.livejournal.com. He gets such interesting guests, and he gets them talking. You can find a complete text transcript of today's interview with Dennis M. Bushnell at peakoil.com. Go to the Peak Oil discussion area and look for the entry posted by Dearth on June 21st. I'll add a link to this show's description at ecoshock.org/eshock08, the Radio EcoShock show for August 8th, 2008. So what do you think? Will the oceans burp out methane and kill us all while we're still driving GM Hummers? Or will humans wheel around together to face the common enemy of climate change? I can almost see those green algae energy lakes out in the desert sucking out the CO2 from the atmosphere. I'm Alex Smith. Join us next week for Radio EcoShock. Find all our programs, plus a whole lot of speeches and green radio, free MP3 downloads at ecoshock.org. A word of thanks to the people who grab this program every week from our special radio podcast and get it on the air. EcoShock is now rebroadcast on 15 college and community radio stations at least. If you can't find it in your area, please recommend us. As always, I thank you all for listening. Climate change, peak oil, dollar dropping people, it's time to pump it up with the Black Eyed Peas. Just confess your girl admits that we the shit. F-R-E-S-H, we fresh. G-E-F, that's right, we dip. We definite. B-E-P, we reppin' it. So, turn me up. Turn me up. Turn me up. Come on, baby, just pump it. She ain't down, but chick back there when we in town. She like men on drum. She wanna hit and run. Yeah, that's the speed, that's what we do, that's who we be. B-L-A-C-K-E-Y-A-D-D to the E, then the I to the S. When we play, you shake your ass. Shake it, shake it, shake it, girl. Make sure you don't break it, girl. Turn it up. 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 Come on, baby, just pump it. Down.
on the fill out feels live and direct, rocking the scene. Breaking on down for the B-boys and B-girls, we're in it, do they think? Pump it louder, come on, don't stop, and keep me going, do it. Let's get it on, move it.
Come on, baby, do it.